The expected bounty of the Homestead Act proved illusory, since most of the good land and well-watered areas was already gone, and much of the rest of the miles on each side of a right-of-way was reserved to the railroads. The West was supposed to function as a safety valve for eastern maladjustments. It was considered the garden of the world. And as Hamlin Garland pointed out, all of the associations called up by the spoken word of the West were fabulous, mythic, hopeful. Fred Shannon has proven by careful statistical research that the safety valve was no more than an illusion, but it was an important illusion, which may well have continued to give hope to many despairing farmers long after any reason for hope was gone, and it certainly gave hope to despairing social scientists. A more important and more real safety valve for them, for the farmers that is, was the city, or, if they stayed on the farm, the rising value of land. It was their only possession which went up in value, and periodic mortgages kept some farmers going. By 1890, there were more mortgages than farms in five of the northern plains states. It was easy to blame the railroads, which had turned out to be a scourge rather than a boon, or the middleman. The dairy farmer only received about 50% of the consumer's price, and the wheat farmer only 17%, or the banker, who charged 8 or 12% or more interest on mortgages. But above all, the farmer blamed the governmental policies of deflation. Through farmers' clubs, the Grange, and later the alliances, the farmers tried to bring about regulation of railroad rates, establishment of cooperatives, and other reforms, all of which met with mixed success. But above all, the farmer tried to bring about inflation. Or perhaps it would be fairer to say he tried to bring about an end to deflation, in order at least to bring prices back up to what they had been. If the farmer succeeded, he at least would not have to pay back in wheat and meat so much more on his mortgage than he or his father had borrowed. He hoped that by getting more money in circulation, he could bring about higher prices, and tried first with greenbacks and then with silver to get at least $50 a person into circulation. Eastern bankers and merchants were sure that this would be disastrous. And yet we can note today that in 1950 there is about $200 per person in circulation, four times more than the farmers demanded. Since manufactured goods would have advanced in price at least as rapidly as farm commodities, inflation obviously would have been little more than a panacea. Yet the farmers' demand for it has been one of the most persistent forces in American history from the colonial period to the present. In order to gain inflation, the farmers would have to gain control of the government and obtain enabling legislation, and there were few in Congress to help them. In 1870, while 47% of the population derived its living from agriculture, only 7% of the members of Congress had any direct connection with the soil. And the politicians showed a peculiar sensitivity toward the requests of industrialists and the same sort of deftness toward those of the farmers. Politicos were not merely the pawns of the industrialists and bankers, although many of them did serve on boards of directors, and almost all of them shared in the faith in the gospel of wealth. At first, during the degrading day years of Reconstruction and the Grant regime, on a national down to a city level, they did seem to function as looters and plunderers, indulging in graft and selling legislation to the highest bidder. But this gross age, fortunately, did not last long. Decent people were shocked at revelations of the manipulations of the tweed ring, the gas ring, and the whiskey ring. And perhaps more important, corporate leaders felt they were being overcharged for the legislation, or lack of legislation, which they bought. The price easily could become prohibitive. The Central Pacific, later Southern Pacific, for example, had to spend as much as $500,000 per year for lobbying activities. The farmer, note, had no money to spend for the purchase of legislation. And after 1876, the industrialists began to invest their political funds more prudently. They began to contribute to the campaign fund, and in order to hedge, frequently gave to both parties. Then it was not of too much importance whether Democrats or Republicans were in office. When occasionally the public pressure became too great, the Congress would pass some great reform measure, which on careful analysis would usually turn out not to reform at all. Thus, the farmer did get the Bland-Allison Act and the Sherman-Silver Purchase Act, neither of which brought any real measure of inflation. And Senator Orville Platt of Connecticut charged during the Sherman Bill debate, "The conduct of the Senate has not been in the line of the honest preparation of a bill to prohibit and punish trusts. It has been in the line of getting some bill with that title that we might go to the country with. The questions of whether the bill would be operative or how it would operate have been whistled down the wind in this Senate as idle talk, and the whole effort has been to get some bill headed, a bill to punish trusts, with which to go to the country." There is scant wonder that by the bleak 90s, many farmers were losing hope of getting relief through either party and were joining a third party, the Populist or People's Party. In the Farm Belt, they screamed out their defiance in words that sounded harsh in the East. Mother Mary Lease, the pythoness of the prairies, proclaimed in Topeka in 1890, "Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street." And her recommendation was the worst shocker of all because of the words this lady used. "What you farmers need to do is to raise less corn and more hell." The farmers were not alone in suffering acutely during the Depression of the 1890s. Millions of laboring men were unemployed and, like the farmers, turned to the government in vain. President Grover Cleveland concerned himself with maintaining the credit of the government and the gold standard. General Jacob Coxey was locked up briefly in the Washington jail merely for trying to petition Congress for a mild sort of WPA. A combination of working men and farmers might bring political victory in 1896 and thereafter legislate themselves government aid from Washington. The inflationary or silver forces captured the Democratic Party and nominated William Jennings Bryan, but the farmers could not muster sufficient labor support. Employed working men had little to gain from higher prices and were frightened by employers' threats of layoffs if Bryan won. Consequently, in November, the victory went to William McKinley and industrialism. The Depression had frightened Americans, even though some of them might not have directly suffered from it. For the first time, some of them were rather pessimistic about the future, for the great railway network was constructed and its stimulus upon the economy a thing of the past. Frederick Jackson Turner, in declaring the frontier to have been the most significant force in American history, proclaimed it to be at an end. If it were, where were American industrialists with their huge trusts to turn for an expanding market? And where within the American system were the promoters to find opportunities to take large risks in order to make large profits? These questions seemed less important as the country began to recover from the Depression early in the McKinley administration. But within 2 years, the Spanish-American War pointed an answer to some of them. The new American frontier lay overseas. Into the martial spirit of nationalism, the American malcontents could pour much of their frustrations. The Texas congressman realized that in 1895, when Cleveland's Secretary of State was taking a firm stand against Britain over the Monroe Doctrine. "Why, Mr. Secretary," he wrote, "just think of how angry the anarchistic, socialistic, and populist boil appears on our political surface, and who knows how deep its roots extend or ramify. One cannon shot across the bow of a British boat in defense of this principle will knock more pus out of it than would suffice to inoculate and corrupt our people for the next 2 centuries. At the same time, colonial empire could provide a new market for American factories and for risk capital, new chances for large profits." Already, James Roosevelt, who had been president of the first American railroad holding company, had become head of another speculative venture of the new sort outside the United States, a private company to dig an interoceanic canal at Nicaragua. But while foreign affairs, which Professor Kurt will discuss next week, might solve some of the problems of the industrialists in a maturing American economy, the defeat of Bryan had postponed settlement of those of the farmers, laborers, and above all, the middle class. The backlog of demands for reform formed the agenda for the progressive era. And in this new era, the politician, the political promoter, rather than the industrialist or industrial promoter, became a key figure. It was symbolic that the son of James Roosevelt, the promoter, was Franklin D. Roosevelt, the president.